From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudet. You're listening to Idaho Matters. Former President Donald Trump has now been indicted four times, twice in federal court, twice in county courts in Manhattan and Georgia. And so far, there are more than 90 counts for alleged crimes, including falsifying business records in the Stormy Daniels case, keeping classified documents at Mar-a-Lago, conspiracy charges related to January 6th, and the latest indictment for trying to change the outcome of the Georgia presidential election. Dr. David Adler says the indictments raise questions about the rule of law, our Constitution, as well as American democracy. Adler is the head of the Alturas Institute, and he will be holding one of his constitutional conversations at Boise State's Yonke Institute this Thursday to talk about the implications of those indictments. And he's joining us now. Welcome back to Idaho Matters.
Thank you very much, Gemma. Nice to be with you as always. Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about the charges against the former president. As I mentioned, four different indictments. In your opinion, which one do you think is the most serious charge from a constitutional standpoint?
That's an excellent question. The reality is they're all very serious charges raising grave issues of importance for the nation and the rule of law. I think that the conspiracy and the conspiracies and charges related to the January 6 offenses represent probably the most brutal facts of this case, because that represented an effort to thwart a solemn constitutional process, counting the electoral votes, which means that that was the moment where American democracy stood on a very thin line and the future of the rule of law was at stake. Because if Donald Trump had succeeded in his effort to obstruct the Electoral College count, that would have meant that he would have been able to disenfranchise millions of Americans, essentially denying the right of the American people to choose their own leaders, the most solemn fundamental right of a citizen living in a democracy. So the effort to obstruct that count, frankly, the effort to engage in a coup, and he succeeded in stopping a governmental process for hours, represents such a grave, unprecedented threat to our country that, Gemma, I would probably have to rank that number one, but that's not to disparage at all the seriousness of the other indictments, many indictments, and you indicated there were 91. So this is a serious moment in American history where the rule of law and democracy and constitutional government are at stake with respect to these cases involving Donald Trump.
So, Dr. Adler, I've spoken with some legal experts who also say that these charges in Georgia are really not necessarily just the most serious, but could be the charges that actually convict Donald Trump. With that said, what's interesting to me about it is that they used the RICO Act to indict not just the former president, but numerous other people. And a lot of times, you know, people assume when they see the RICO Act, you think the mafia. But Georgia is kind of unique in how they can charge like this. Can you talk a little bit about that and kind of how that works into just all of, you know, our democracy?
Sure. I think that the use of the RICO statute was very, very smart. And of course, it brings a sweeping indictment of essentially 19 people, Donald Trump and 18 co-defendants. And the reality is that the RICO statute applies here very well because this was, as the DA pointed out, a criminal enterprise. And it certainly does reflect the tendencies of the behavior of the mafia. And we're accustomed to reading about mob bosses being brought down under RICO statutes. This was a criminal enterprise. And Fani Willis, the district attorney in Fulton County, pointed out that Donald Trump was the head of this criminal organization. And so the statute is very important because it's a way of telling the full story here, the full narrative, allowing the district attorney to draw the strings together, connecting the effort to overturn the election in Georgia to similar efforts in other states, Michigan and Arizona among them, where the approach is the same. And so that's why the RICO statute is important here, because this is essentially a multi-state effort undertaken to overturn, to frankly steal the election and deny Americans their right as sovereign citizens to choose their leaders. And I think certainly your other guests have been correct about this point. I think that the alleged facts are very clear, and you would expect that the charges brought by Fani Willis are going to be very hard for Donald Trump to defeat. And let's face it, in this case, the district attorney is able to use Trump's own words, his own actions against him. And of course, millions of people have listened to the voice of Donald Trump when he made a threatening call to the Georgia Secretary of State, asking him to, quote, find the 11,780 votes. And he said, I just need that number. Just give me a break. And then going on further, and we all heard his voice, indicating that the Secretary of State would be in serious trouble if he didn't do Trump's bidding. Those are chilling words. Those are chilling actions by a former president, the 45th president of the United States, who swore an oath to uphold the Constitution and the laws of the United States. And now, of course, as the indictments indicate, he's behaving very much like a mafia boss. And I think what Americans need to understand that this is a ruthless undertaking with no concern about the citizenry, no interest in democracy or the rule of law or constitutional government. This is wholly about the ends justifying the means. And that's chilling to the core. It strikes at the very essence of American democracy and constitutional government. So I very much admire the courage and the intelligence and the acumen of this district attorney in utilizing the RICO statute and bringing charges against Trump and 18 others who were all involved in a grand conspiracy to overturn American democracy.
So let's talk about the fact that when these alleged crimes were committed, Donald Trump was either the sitting president or former president. In the case of Georgia with that conversation with then Secretary of State Raffensperger, that was January 2nd, 2021. He was still the president when he had that conversation. So Dr. Adler, how does that impact the cases against him? Because we've heard time and time again, we've never seen something like this in our democracy. This is new. There is no precedent.
Well, you're exactly right. And the fact that he was at that point a sitting president of the United States does not bring him any further protection against all these charges. In fact, I think the very fact that he engaged in such chilling behavior is all the more damning, precisely because he takes an oath to uphold the Constitution of the laws of the United States. You're not enforcing the laws of the United States when you're essentially threatening a Secretary of State to count the votes in a different way so as to secure an illegal victory for the sitting president. And of course, that violates his very clear, crisp duty under Article 2 of the Constitution, which provides that the president shall take care to faithfully execute the laws of the land. And the very fact that he would use the power of the federal government, all the power of the presidency to intimidate people, including the secretary, to engage in the worst kind of unlawful, undemocratic action, is not only chilling, but it's beyond the pale by any measurement. And the reality here is that the effort to bring that man to justice for his efforts to tear down the walls of democracy, to gut the rule of law, is not only commendable, it's admirable. And I think probably will be regarded by historians as one of the most outstanding moments in American history for the effort to defend the rule of law. The very idea that a president might be immune from charges precisely because he is the office holder is alarming. It reminds us, of course, of what Richard Nixon said in one of his interviews with David Frost in May of 1977, when Nixon really revealed himself by saying to in the interview, well, if the president does it, then it's not illegal. No president had ever asserted that. And of course, that's what Trump is embracing. And it's not surprising because there's a clear line of connection in thinking about the role of government and the excessive powers of the presidency between Richard Nixon and Donald Trump. And they shared mentors, they shared friends, they shared advisors. So that's a really interesting kind of continuity. But for Nixon to utter those lines that the president is essentially above the law and can authorize illegal actions by others, of course, not only threatens the very fabric of the rule of law, but would bring down constitutional government. And it is utterly without any fact in American law, without any history. And indeed, if we go all the way back, Gemma, to 1804, in a landmark case called Little versus Barame, the great Chief Justice John Marshall held that a president may not authorize an illegal act, because to assert that a president enjoys the power to violate the law himself or to authorize others to violate statutes would hoist the president above the law. And as Marshall pointed out, the very essence of the rule of law at the time of the founding was the subordination of the president to the law, a completely novel concept in the history of constitutional government at that time. One of the framers' greatest achievements, I think, was subordinating the president to the rule of law. But the maintenance of that great achievement, as we all know, requires that we always have good men and women at the helm who will uphold these principles and not bow to thugs who would undermine our system, to threaten them, to intimidate them, because the law is not a machine that goes of itself. The Constitution is not a self-executing instrument. Without men and women of dignity and integrity in the key positions to uphold these principles, no matter how beautifully written the Constitution is or perfectly drawn any statute might be, law by itself cannot protect the nation. We need good citizens who are in positions of responsibility. And they were there, of course, in the 2020 election and resisted the efforts by Trump and his henchmen to overturn the election. So this indictment, this great issue of whether a sitting president or even a former president should be judged by any standards other than those that are applicable to every American citizen, is a non-starter. It's simply a non-starter. James Wilson in the Constitutional Convention, who was second in importance only to James Madison, by the way, said that the president enjoys no privileges not enjoyed by other American citizens. That is the essential summary of what the framers were attempting to do when they wrote Article 2 of the Constitution and placed the president in a position of being subordinate to the rule of law.
So, Dr. Adler, Trump is the current leading candidate to win the 2024 GOP nomination for president. How does this impact, once again, these cases, these charges against him?
That's such a fine question. And I think it's on the minds of people all over this country, Gemma. The reality is that there's no clearer, more stark, more lethal way of repudiating the rule of law than to assert politics as a defense. And of course, that's what Donald Trump is trying to do through his attorneys asking judges to delay the cases, to start trial dates even after the 2024 election, essentially trying to delay. And he, of course, asserts that the indictments and any effort to place him on trial represents an interference with the election. But if we were to adopt that view, it would mean that anybody could commit a crime. Somebody could rob a bank and say, "Oh, you can't try me now because I'm running for office." So that simply won't do. It's pretty absurd, and the rule of law cannot take a back seat to the assertion. Now, judges can be mindful of the upcoming election system and schedule the trials in a way that could begin before the primary season. That's okay. But in this case, delaying the trials, I think, would be evidence of that old statement that justice delayed is justice denied. The defendant has a right to a speedy trial under the Sixth Amendment. The court has said the public interest is strong in having a speedy trial. And so we really need to begin, at least the federal case out of D.C. relating to January 6th before the primaries in early January, as special counsel Jack Smith has asked the court to do.
Dr. Adler, I have read conflicting views on this, and it is in regards to can the former president actually become president, even run for president when he is facing the indictments that he is facing. In your opinion, and how you interpret the Constitution, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, of course, he is capable of running as a candidate to become president. And if elected, he can serve. Some people wonder how could a convicted felon holding the office of the president ever serve time behind bars? And people have said, well, he wouldn't be in jail. He would be under house arrest or something because he enjoys Secret Service protection. But on that point, we should note that Secret Service protection is afforded by Congress under statute. And a president can lose Secret Service protection if he or she is impeached. I think that if Trump were convicted, somehow elected, or even without election, be denied Secret Service protection by Congress, because after all, if you can deny Secret Service protection to somebody who has been impeached and removed from office, how is that any less heinous than being convicted of multiple felonies? I think the American people don't have to pay tax dollars to provide an ex-president Secret Service protection who has committed such crimes against the nation. That's number one. Number two, it is the case that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, as you know, provides that nobody can hold office if they've engaged in insurrection or rebellion. And what the January 6th charges indicate is that Trump was very much involved in the efforts to overturn American government by denying the counting of the electoral votes. Now, that's a theory. It's never been tested in court, and no doubt any effort to bar a president from a place on a ballot at the state level, for example, would be ultimately resolved by the Supreme Court. That's probably not likely to happen, but I think at any rate, the prospect of having a convicted president serving in office is absurd. And that's why the American voters have to respond accordingly and judge that somebody who is convicted of these heinous crimes doesn't have the dignity to serve in office. And that's all the more reason, finally, Gemma, that the trials have to begin and have to be completed before the next election.
Mm-hmm. Long term, what do these charges against Donald Trump mean for the future of American democracy?
You know, I think above all, it's a reminder that the rule of law applies to everybody, and that a sitting president or a former president should not be judged by any standards beyond those that are applied to every other American citizen. To do so would be to suggest that American law can be applied differently to different people. And that would violate the very essence of the equal protection of the law, which, going all the way back to Aristotle, has meant that we apply the law equally to all people. That's a great goal, not always achieved, as we know, in our country. But in this case, to provide a president with a pass or an opportunity to invoke privileges and immunities to escape accountability would represent a grave threat to the rule of law and to American democracy.
Mm-hmm. In your opinion, how do you believe that the outcome of these four indictments, which we don't know what the outcome will be on them, I should say, but yeah. How do you believe that that can impact the view of the presidency? And what I mean by that is how we as you know, citizens view the presidency, how we view the Constitution as we move forward.
That's such an important question. I'm glad you ask it. There, for a long time, we've faced in this country a reckoning with respect to the scope of presidential power. And of course, at least since the mid-1960s, with the rise of the imperial presidency under Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, the imperial presidency has never been grounded. At times, it's flown at a somewhat less elevated level, but there have been presidents of both parties, liberal and conservative, Republican and Democrat, who have asserted powers that simply aren't grounded in the Constitution. So we need a reckoning. Mm-hmm. What Donald Trump has done is unprecedented and far above and beyond anything involving previous presidents. We need this reckoning so that American citizens can understand, as the framers of the Constitution conceived of it, that the president is there to serve the American people, that he is bound by constitutional limitations, bound by statutory provisions, and that he's not a sovereign, not above the law. And so the impact ultimately, I think, in answering your question, is that American citizens would understand once more that we have a limited presidency, that the institution will have been humbled, and we should move past the idea of holding any conceptions or misconceptions that the president is above the law. I hope that would be the impact of these trials. I fear that partisan supporters of Donald Trump will cry foul, claim there was a mm-hmm. conspiracy. And so there would still be great work ahead, Gemma, to remind Americans that in America, we're governed by law and not men.
Dr. Adler, I only have about a minute and a half left with you. And I think that's a very interesting point you bring up, right? That this idea that this is a political witch hunt, instead of looking at it as, well, I mean, he is a former president. He happened to decide to run again, but I would make the argument that even if he hadn't decided to run again, these investigations started way before he said he would run again. Does that make sense?
It certainly does. That's very true. These investigations were underway before he decided to become a candidate. It's likely the case that he announced his candidacy somewhat early because he thought that the announcement would forfend the investigations that were already underway. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's a misplaced idea. But sitting presidents and former presidents alike need to be held to the same standards that apply to others. And we cannot allow politics to be used as a defense against the rule of law.
Well, as always, Dr. Adler, so appreciate you coming in and talking with us in depth about this. Really appreciate your perspective.
Thanks so much for having me. Take care.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Want to learn how to be a master of business without going back to school? Listen to the Planet Money MBA. No suits, no PowerPoints, just the secrets of business school delivered straight to your ears. Every Wednesday till Labor Day on Planet Money from NPR.